Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
The realistic proposal from Greece will have to be matched by an equally realistic proposal on debt sustainability from the creditors. Only then will we have a win-win situation.
So says European Council President Donald Tusk. Greece is back at the drawing board as Europe awaits plans for yet another restructuring of Greece's debt, or yet another rearrangement of the Titanic's deck chairs. My guests Tim Marshall and Sebastian Borger will discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the imminent descent of yet another deadline for a deal over Iran's nuclear program, a dim glimmer of hope for Yemen, and Tunisia's plans to keep the jihad out. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller on Monocle 24 right now. And a warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Tim Marshall, former diplomatic editor at Sky News, now editor of thewhatandthewhy.com and recently author of Prisoners of Geography, and Sebastian Borger, UK correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, among other journals. Welcome both back to the show.
Thank you.
We will start tonight with Greece. Sometime between now and 2300 hours UK time tonight, Greece is due to submit yet more proposals to secure yet another bailout ahead of a full EU summit on Sunday. In Greece, banks will remain closed until at least Monday, and restrictions on cash machines remain in force. As the world's op-ed writers gouge the ground beneath overscraped barrels, for more analogies and puns drawn from Greek fable, the desperation on all sides for some sort of resolution is palpable. And I speak as someone, I ran out of Greece jokes 3 years ago. Sebastian, why wouldn't Greece, whatever Greece is going to suggest, between now and 2300 hours, why wouldn't they have suggested it before now?
That's exactly my question. Yes, I can't for the life of me understand it, and so of course can increasingly fewer politicians in the rest of Europe, not least in my own country. I mean, the Social Democrats, who were broadly sympathetic to Syriza when they came to power, have gone totally off them. You know, they've lost how to lose friends and have ever less influence is the study that will be written about this Syriza government.
More than one person has commented, certainly since the referendum result on Sunday, that among many bequests to our language, Greece does give us the Pyrrhic victory. Tim, is it possible that whatever deal Greece can secure, if they can secure one, might actually end up being substantially worse than the one they voted against on Sunday?
No, because if they will just compromise, they'll get pretty similar deal to the one that they rejected, which was, you know, the one perhaps in retrospect they might be thinking they should have taken. Can I just correct an error in your introduction?
Please do.
They need to get the proposals in by 2023.
2023?
Yeah, the year. I think that's what's taking so long. Their minds are simply not concentrated. I mean, you know, send in the clowns that ought to be clowns. I don't want to be Cassandra, because you've picked four subjects and I'm going to be unfortunately negative probably about all of them, but I am not ideological. You know, I don't have a Marxist bent or a rabid capitalist bent, but these guys are off the scale. The new finance minister, who seems eminently more sensible than the previous one, turned up at the talks on Tuesday, with some notes scribbled on his hotel paper. Those were his bullet points that he tried to present to at this crisis meeting. And everyone just looked at him and thought, what? You knew about your referendum for the last 9 days. You haven't proposed anything. You haven't brought anything. Today, you've got the Prime Minister sounding off in, I think he's in Strasbourg. What's he doing in Strasbourg? They're also playing another game. Today, the energy minister has unveiled the plans they've got with Russia for South Stream. This is the alternative way of getting gas through to Europe. Why is he doing that? He is emotionally and financially and politically trying to blackmail the rest of the EU, because the EU doesn't want South Stream. If South Stream comes on stream, the Russians have an alternative of way of feeding gas in, meaning that Europe is still reliant on Russia. So are they being good Europeans at the moment? Of course they're not. But of course they're saying that their other 27 European Union neighbours are wrong.
Sebastian, as Tim quite correctly points out, this whole thing does at this point have rather a whiff of a Marx Brothers script about it. To what extent now, and you were alluding there earlier to the evaporation of German patients with Greece, but to what extent now is the rest of the EU motivated by some kind of urge to actually punish Greece, not only for its own erratic behaviour, but also, I guess, as a cautionary example to Spain or Italy?
Well, we're all, apart from a thin veneer of rationality, emotional people, aren't we? And obviously, I think that must play a part. But I still think there are enough clever people in the conference rooms of Brussels and elsewhere who realize that, you know, anything that will happen now is going to be a bad outcome. All we're about now is to avoid the worst outcome. And the problem, of course, is we're not entirely sure which one it is, you know? Yeah. Because I have to say, increasingly, I wonder whether a Grexit... And that's me saying it, who has, I think, fairly consistently in the last months argued for patience and to keep them to keep Greece in the Eurozone and all that, and for debt relief and all that. But, you know, increasingly, you have to, if you seriously consider debt relief, you've got to have a partner who you can deal with, who you've got some trust. Credere, the Italian word for credit, not even in a financial sense, but you've got to believe in them. And I don't see people believing in them.
And there's this dwindling band of true believers who, for ideological reasons, will just refuse to accept anything other than, oh, this is the horrible, nasty EU ganging up on the Greece. It's almost racist. I mean, it's just nonsense. Several years ago, when the Irish went through something similar, they compromised and they went through some pretty hard times in their economy.
Very hard times.
But they did it and they're still in. And what, did everybody suddenly hate the Irish? No, does everyone suddenly hate the Greeks? No, this is a narrative that they're trying to put out there. And they're wrapping themselves in the cloak of nationalism.
Very unpleasant.
And well, Sebastian knows they've been, the word Nazi is being knocked around willy-nilly. One of our own correspondents from British television accused an anti-Syriza supporter of being a Nazi collaborator the other day. I mean, what is this sort of nonsense? I mean, be rational.
That is singularly absurd rhetoric. Sebastian, we've talked a bit about the impatience of Germany's government, which I suspect is being fueled at least partly by an impatience of the German electorate. But there's also another, I think, under-discussed theme here, which is that the European Union, as it's now constituted, does actually contain several countries noticeably poorer than Greece, and who have been saying, both officially and when their people are asked by visiting reporters, really, you know, how much patience are we supposed to have?
Very tough. I mean, I don't think you have ever heard anything from Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister, as tough as you've heard it from Mr. Kazimir, the Slovakian finance minister, or the Finnish. Well, the Finns are much richer than the Greeks, but, you know, yeah. Lithuania.
No, but I'm talking about the language.
Estonia. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, the Slovakia. These are the countries who I think are running out of patients actually faster than the Belgians, the Dutch, and the Germans.
Tim, final thought on this, because I rather suspect, what with one thing and another, we may be coming back to this story next week. Would dumping Greece out of the euro, or Greece exiting the euro, really be that troublesome for everybody else? Because surely by now, everybody has factored in this possibility.
I don't think it would be that bad. It's 2% of the GDP of the entire European Union bloc, so that they can go. And God willing, if they came back to the drachma, could make a success of it. I don't know if that's possible. The problem is psychological, that if you let one go, do the speculators go for the others? But against that, the ECB has put in these measures. They have stockpiled money to try and see off the sharks that will circle. Very briefly, when you talk about this, if you start criticising the Greeks, you very quickly get criticised as if you're some sort of rabid anti-Greek person. I think it's awful what's happening to the Greek people. I fear that the splits in their society, which go back to the civil war of 44 and 45, they're going to widen. And I think we should do a lot to try and help mitigate the suffering of the Greek people. But that does not mean you have to look at these clowns that are running around way out of their depth, who next year will all go back to well-paid jobs in universities while some proper politicians get in charge.
Well, let's persist with the theme of interminable negotiations between a group of nations and one other country which won't get with the programme. Discussions between the P5 plus one and Iran over the future of the Islamic Republic's nuclear programme missed their most recent deadline on June 30th, to the surprise of nobody at all. Talks are ongoing in Vienna but are now up against another deadline, which is that if they can't come up with something by midnight tomorrow Washington time, the US Congress will have twice as long to scrutinise any deal, i.e. twice as long to scupper. Now, news just in the last few minutes. This is out of Fars, the Iranian news agency, saying talks to be extended for 4 more days. These poor people cloistered in Vienna, apparently with extremely rickety air conditioning in the middle of a heat wave, will have to do another 4 more days. Tim, first of all, in your previous life as diplomatic editor of Sky News, you must have sat in on more than a few of similar bun fights. How are everyone's nerves likely to be at this point?
Oh, people are exhausted. Their nerves are shredded. They're frustrated. They get glimmers of hope as a door creaks open, and then they put their fingers in it, and it slams shut. It just goes on and on, because you're almost at the deal, and someone tugs a little piece of string, and a large part of it unravels. Little things really matter. The aircon failed yesterday. Mm. I mean, it actually does matter. You've got people who are exhausted, who are talking about essentially war and peace, and they're frazzled, hot, bothered, and exhausted, and they're eating junk food getting sent in from outside. I mean, you know, these things actually do matter, and I don't envy them. We used to call them three-shirters. Is it a three-shirter? You used to go for three nights, you've got to take three shirts. And what is this, an 11-shirter?
It'll be a 15-shirter
The news you just said, sorry, Sebastian, the news you just said about this, the extension, actually is quite meaningful, as I'm sure Sebastian's going to tell us.
Can I defend Vienna here?
I like Vienna. They're not in Vienna, they're in a hotel.
Being the correspondent for a Viennese newspaper. Now, Vienna has washing machines. Vienna has Vienna has very, very lovely restaurants where you can eat very well, unless you are a fan of junk
or stuck in a hotel.
If occasionally the aircon misses a beat, well, then you take a little ride on the Danube and gather your thoughts. No, but seriously, I mean, it seems as if there is. I have not very much insight, but it seems to me that Iran is the one dragging its feet, aren't they?
There seems to be three key issues, and only two of them have been mentioned. One is missiles, because they are doing a lot of work on long-range missiles, mm-hmm. and they don't seem to want to give it up. Another one is when sanctions will be lifted. And I think even both of those two, it's what they're so close to. The one that's not getting mentioned is inspection. And there was a phrase came out last week called access, managed inspections, which I thought was a fudge word that would allow managed inspections of the military sites, because that is an issue of sovereignty and they're sticking on it as far as I'm concerned. I've seen nothing that's come out that suggested that the idea that the UN inspectors can go in there willy-nilly without any advance notice has been settled. And I think that is a breaking point. Now, let's see if they come out with a deal. Obama is desperate for a deal, but because they've now gone past tonight, which is the deadline after the deadline after the deadline, they've now got a new one. It means that Congress will spend months, many of them, congressmen and women, unpicking any deal that does emerge, and they'll have twice as long to unpick it as they would have had if they could have concluded it tonight.
And also, of course, the president can't lift the sanctions while Congress is scrutinising
The American press is full at the moment of a debate about the presidential powers. How much can he waive this? How much can he have a decree? How much then can Congress come back? But there is no question that because of this extension to the extension to the extension, things have got even more complicated.
Sebastian, how much sense do you think we have of how much domestic pressure Iran's leaders are under to come up with a deal? Because, I mean, I can't claim to be an expert on Iran. I've spent a grand total, I think, of 36 hours in Tehran in 2006, I think. But even in that time, I did get a definite sense from
Tell
people.
Tell us more.
I can't claim the people I met to be a scientific sample, but they were just desperately weary of being walled off from the rest of the world, of being isolated, of being seen as a pariah state. I mean, I think a lot comes down to whether the Iranian people want to be part of the rest of the world more than they want to be a nuclear-armed state.
But isn't there also a faction in the country, and still very powerful, which insists on national sovereignty and insists on calling America the Great Satan, and have quite a bit to lose from this wonderful and energetic country actually opening up to the world economy? So you know, I think there are different, as in any other country, there are different powers tugging in different directions.
I mean, what's your sense of that, Tim? Because that's an interesting thought, the extent to which the Iranian leadership as it is may kind of fear the idea of Iran being reincorporated back into the mainstream of diplomatic relations, if you will. Yeah. I mean, the people who run Iran, whatever you think of them, they're not stupid. They understand that a great many of the country's extremely young urban population is kind of tired of living the way it's been living.
I'm going to take issue partially with that in a moment. Who built the Tehran underground tube system, metro system? The Revolutionary Guard built it. The Revolutionary Guard is a massive industrial complex, huge business profit-making. And they do stand to possibly make some money if Iran opens up, but others will make more money. The Revolutionary Guard is a money-making enterprise. And the second part is that there are still genuine ideologues who do not want to give up the revolution. It's their life's work. They're not going to see their life's work unraveled. Now, as to what you said about the population, I agree with you. There are millions of people straining to join much more the modern world and push their headscarves back another 2 or 3 inches. And they're the ones that we go and interview when
yeah,
we go there.
It's
right.
the confirmation bias of the Western media.
Is it not the case that for every student holding a banner saying they want reform, there is another young person joining the Basij militia and joining the Revolutionary Guard?
Absolutely. This was the mistake that got made during the Arab Spring. The Western media went to Cairo and interviewed all the cool kids.
Although, Iran is not obviously an Arab country, and it is a different situation, and I suspect there are more educated, liberalish type-minded people that we would sort of recognize more a bit like ourselves, but don't underestimate the amount of real conservatism in Iran and the vested interests that have got their money and their power and their life's work tied up in the Islamic Revolution.
Final thought on this one from you, Sebastian. You were earlier saying that you were about ready to abandon your optimism about Greece and the euro. How optimistic are you that 4 days from now we will be celebrating a deal between Iran and the other powers?
Not very optimistic at all.
You and me both. I suspect this is also a subject to which we will be returning. For the moment, we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Tim Marshall and Sebastian Borger. Coming up next, perhaps cause for relative optimism in Yemen and Tunisia's decision to invest more faith in good fences than good neighbours.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Istanbul, our bureau chief is Christopher Lord.
From our bureau in Karaköy, we're extremely close to the heart of the city. We've got a view towards the Golden Horn. So from here, we're able to not only look across Turkey towards Anatolia, but also further towards Central Asia and that extremely important shipping lane at the Bosphorus is to Central Asia.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Tim Marshall and Sebastian Borger. Now, Yemen has offered little good news in recent months, or even much in the way of not awful news. A war between Iran-sponsored Houthi rebels and a Saudi-backed government with unhelpful contributions from Islamic State and the local Al-Qaeda franchise has left thousands dead or displaced and the country on the verge of humanitarian disaster. However, according to the Houthis news agency, a ceasefire with the government will be agreed within 24 hours. Tim Marshall, first of all, how optimistic should we be about this?
Very, because it's the only hope in town. vary because what they're looking at is a humanitarian truce, not ending of the war. If you're a real optimist, you think, OK, if they could just get 3 to 5 days peace, no more bombing, no shooting, get a shed load of humanitarian aid in, and whilst they're doing that, 5 days of calm, they can actually start talking and then they can get a proper peace deal. What has happened in the past is that it's broken down or it's come to the end of its 3 days and they've started shooting again. That is probably what will happen unless there is more to this, because there are some conditions. For example, if you want to extend it, the Houthis have to release the defence minister, former defence minister who they've captured. It's got to be a big exchange of prisoners. The problem is that the outside powers haven't finished yet. I think the Houthis and the government forces can probably come to an arrangement within themselves. But outside, Iran and Saudi Arabia and others are pushing, and I don't think they've finished their fight yet. So until they've all agreed that they're not going to push anymore, it will probably be a temporary ceasefire. Let's hope I'm wrong.
Sebastian Borger, those conditions that Tim mentioned are among those being dictated by Yemeni President Abid Rabu Mansour Hadi, who has been in exile in Saudi Arabia for some considerable time now. Does he still matter at this point? I mean, he is officially the president of Yemen. The UN Security Council has passed a resolution recognising him as same or upholding him as same. But one could argue that when you need the UN Security Council passing resolutions reminding everybody that you're president, you've got fairly big problems, haven't you?
That is true, but it is still a some sort of authority, isn't it? The Security Council. So yes, I think he does matter, and he needs to be at the table, and they need to, as Tim says, get down and find a space to talk. That's all we can ask for, and we'll hope they'll get that.
There is no Yemen. It's finished. It will probably go back to a north-south Yemen, two countries that it used to be, and the Houthis can go back up north where they're all from, but I'm afraid there's a lot of killing to be done before that happens.
Are the Houthis likely to give up what they have in the south?
Yeah, I think they would for the right deal, yeah, especially if you give them the capital. The capital of the ex-country of Yemen, which actually still exists on paper.
Okay, well, finally tonight, it is 25 years, give or take, since Europe was celebrating the dismantling of walls that had divided it during the Cold War. In the last few weeks, however, one European country, Hungary, has decided to build a new one along its border with Serbia to deter migrants crossing the Balkans. And now one North African country is following suit, Tunisia, which plans to wall off all 160 kilometres of its border with turbulent Libya in order to keep out jihadis. Sebastian, Tunisia first, is this the spectacle of a government still following a dreadful terrorist attack on holidaymakers recently? Is it still in something must be done mode, or is this actually going to work?
A government in shock. Well, I mean, I've looked at the map, and it seems. It's easier to build, I suppose, than the wall or the fence between the two Germanies was, because it's fairly flat territory.
And sand.
Well, they're talking about a long trench and sand fortifications. Yes, well. But to be fair, of course, they are also doing some other things. I mean, they're closing down what they seem to think are extremist mosques.
Mm. Dozens of them, in fact.
You know, hard to tell whether that's good news or bad. But so it's part of a package. And Libya is, I would suggest, a much more difficult neighbor than Serbia is for Hungary.
I think Libya is pretty much your nightmare neighbour scenario incarnate at this point. Tim, is this going to work? Is this a symbolic gesture? I mean, the obvious parallel, the walls that Sebastian mentioned, the Cold War walls across Europe, those were, of course, built to keep people in rather than to keep people out. Does fencing off 160 kilometres of sand protect Tunisia significantly?
No, perhaps a little bit, but not significantly. To be optimistic, I think I've argued from the very beginning that Tunisia is the one and the only Arab country that does have a chance of coming through the upheavals it's been through and making something of a success. That said, this wall is not going to make very much difference at all, and it's combating terrorism. That is because apparently it's only going to be about a third of its border. So, okay, I'm just going to keep walking south or north, and they'll
you go round to Algeria and then come in from there.
And so even that third, I don't believe that Tunisia has the technology that, say, the Israelis have. Now, leave to one side what you think about the fence between Israel and Palestine. Just look at it pragmatically, technically. The Israelis have, if you touch that fence, it sends an alarm to a bunch of watchtowers and various things along the entire length of it. If you approach within 100 yards of it, people start seeing you.
They've got eyes on, in my experience, are not shy about telling you they've seen you.
Yes. So, does Tunisia have that? No, it doesn't. It's going to have a big piece of sand, which you'd probably be able to get round, and it's not going to make that much difference. I agree with Sebastian. They are doing X, Y, and Z, and they're trying, and I've got a lot of time and respect for the Tunisian authorities who have tried to find a middle way. They've even got some of the Islamist parties, Ghannouchi's party, and Ennahda is actually inside the government. They're doing a lot of good things. But this sounds a little bit like window dressing.
I mean, well, but sorry, if I may say, you need some window dressing.
Yeah, makes you feel good.
You need the accompanying television pictures for tourism. Let's not forget how important tourism is for Tunisia, and that the attack, quite logically, in the extremists' mind, was targeting tourism.
Yeah, after a bomb attack in a city, the next day you see lots and lots of armed policemen or police officers wandering around, and that's supposed to make you feel confident.
And it does.
I mean, it does, even though it would not in any way stop a bomb, a plan. And this is similar. And I do accept the psychological argument that Sebastian makes. I just don't think that you should necessarily see it for more than that.
Yeah, Sebastian, do you think the same is true of this fence Hungary is proposing to build along its border with Serbia? Are they interested in communicating the symbolism as well as the practicality of saying that we don't, you know, you're not welcome here, you can't come in?
Well, it's of course a slightly different matter, isn't it? Because they're it's not extremists, terrorists, people who want to kill people who they're trying to keep up, but normal economic migrants. It's the symbol for a failure of European refugee policies.
And I don't know if you've seen the pictures, but I mean, I know that area quite well, and including the flatland of Vojvodina between Serbia and Hungary. These guys are walking up from Greece. They're walking across Macedonia. They're walking up, sometimes cutting into Montenegro and the hills and the mountains. Then they're going up through Serbia. And then they're getting all the... I mean, it's quite astonishing. A whole family is carrying their bags on that journey in this Balkan heat. It's quite something.
Is there ever an argument for such things, though, do you think? And I'll ask each of you, because I was just thinking, I remember last year there was talk, again, not for the first time, about taking down the so-called peace walls in Belfast, an idea which was fairly staunchly resisted by the communities that live along them. People like them.
Oh, yes. Good fences make good neighbours, is as you alluded to in the introduction. They're terrible symbols of division and problems, but in that particular one you mention, it is quite likely that if you lifted that barrier, there would be incidents which would grow into bigger incidents, and then you'd be back. You could get yourself back to where you used to be. On the fences between nations, the south is moving north, and that is not going to stop. If you could try to make sure that the countries from the south and in the Middle East, and if there were fewer wars and you funded economics and you got good societies going, that would reduce the flow. But that's all it would do, just reduce it. The south is coming north, and the politicians have to manage that.
Sebastian, briefly?
If I may say so, from a Hungarian perspective, to do that kind of thing to your Serbian neighbour is beyond any refugee problems that you may or may not have, is very bad politics.
New times.
We will have to leave it there. Tim Marshall, Sebastian Borger, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's episode. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Henry Rhys Sheridan, Mariana Zuniga and Caroline Hamagren. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Tom Edwards is in the building with Monocle's International Playlist. At 1900 hours, it's Andrew Tuck with The Urbanist, and at 2200 hours, easy for me to say, The Monocle Daily. This show returns, also hosted by me, at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye, and thanks for listening.